Hi, my name's Billy. I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been sober since January the 5th in 1990, and I'm very grateful for that. And my home group's the Monday night beginners meeting in Sparta, New Jersey. And although I am a diehard New Yorker with a vicious resentment still about last year's baseball season, so getting over it. I would have much rather you beat the Devils than my Yankees. It would have been a lot easier for me to accept. I want to thank the committee for having me here. And this is, this is like so like it, after what we just saw, it's almost like, I mean, I felt like I should have came up like under some like rising platform from a, You know, I had someone say to me one time, well, don't you like being in front of the crowds? I'm like, well, I mean, my idea of being in front of a crowd growing up was like coming up on like this massive drum set in like a stadium with 80,000 people, like the drummer of a heavy metal band. Like that was my goal in life. And it's like, you know, if you asked me any day where I was going, it's like I either wanted to play third base for the Yankees and date a supermodel, you know, or I wanted to be the drummer in a heavy metal band and date a porn star. It was like every other day, you know, it was like, you know, that's what my teenage years were like. And this was incredible. I said to someone, I'm soaking this all in because this is the... I'm sure you've heard people say this is a rather unique get-together you have here, and I look forward to seeing it the rest of the weekend, but I'd like to, like anything else good in AA, steal a couple of good ideas and take them home with me. You know, I said I'm an alcoholic, and I'm behind a podium, so I just want to make a couple of things clear. Because there might be someone in here, I don't know who's new, who's old, you know, who's been around, who's back, who's never been here before. I know there's some family members here. I know there's some people from the hotel. So I have to tell my story in a general way out of respect to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I want anyone who's new here to know that if you're looking at me and I'm in a suit and tie and you don't like me already, well, then you and I, we have a lot in common, okay? If you have the ability to see someone walk into your AA meeting or up to your AA podium and not like them and you've never met them, we have a real lot in common. But this is a podium, not a pedestal. And that's the most important thing I can say, is that we're right around the anniversary of the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is Dr. Bob's sobriety date. But one of the things I know that's most important so that I don't start worshiping people in Alcoholics Anonymous instead of trying to find a God is that if Bill was dependent upon his sponsor that day in Akron, his sponsor was drinking. And, you know, God sent him to find a newcomer who happened to be Dr. Bob. And I try to remember that. I don't want anyone ever put me on a pedestal. I try not to put other people on pedestals. And I need to tell on myself and be, you know, as honest as I can be in a general way. But I'll say this, that, you know, today I flew here and I fly all the time for work. And so I'm sitting watching this movie. I've been in the middle of like doing the work again and in the middle of this horrible inventory that if you told me 13 years ago, you know, I would kill for my first inventory back. Because, you know, that part, you know, my part, at least I was drinking for most of it, you know? It is brutal, brutal, brutal to take a hard look at your own life in Alcoholics Anonymous and see how I revert back to old ways of thinking, how... You know, this is a family disease, and, you know, sometimes I'll tell my story and I'll see an Al-Anon woman completely break down because her son is usually not where I am yet. But the story I'm telling sounds all too familiar. And, You know, so here I look, you know, I lost both parents in the last 4 years. I lost a relationship I really care about. Did I really react to all of those things in the way I should have? You know, blah, 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 blah. And then I'm watching Antoine Fisher and I'm having like a nervous breakdown, you know. You know, and I'm like, shut that movie off, you know. But I guess the message, or what I'm trying to say is, I don't have a shot unless I stay away from a drink a day at a time. I've never had a shot unless I stay away from a drink a day at a time. You know, I can tell you drinking, I'm not writing columns down on paper. You know, drinking, I don't want to take a look at my part in things. When I'm sober, I have a shot. And I also want to say that I don't, you know, I know that I'm looking out at a room full of heroes. You know, there's a lot of heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're not all speakers. I hate to say that, but it's just true. You know, we're not waiting for a long line of people to wait to accept speaking commitments at conferences. We are waiting for people to bring meetings into institutions. We are short on people answering the phones that keep our fellowship alive. We could probably use a couple of more GSRs in both fellowships. I just know that's the truth, and that's the real service in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is an honor and a privilege, but this doesn't keep me sober. You know, I have to be part of a regular AA community. You know, I said when he said, how should I introduce him? Say, he's Billy from New Jersey, and his home group's glad he's in California, you know? Because, you know, we all know that the expert is the person furthest from home in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? The person furthest from home sounds the best because no one knows them, you know? If you know the person that you're meeting, and, you know, AA saved my life. And I still suffer from alcoholism today. I'm going to tell my story in a general way. If I happen to throw an opinion out and you don't agree with it, believe me, I'll be here all weekend. I'm glad to hear your side of it. I really am. But of all the soapboxes that I have in Alcoholics Anonymous, I really only have one left. And that is the greatest lie that I think that's told in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is that if you haven't been to prison or jail, you have nothing to share with male or female inmates who are going to recovery meetings in jail. And because I know that lie has been perpetrated by people who have never been recovering members inside a correctional facility. Because those of us that have been know the truth. I know the truth. The truth is I don't need another example like myself walking in. You know, I really don't. I need somebody, a man who's about as far away from what I am and who I want to get to be like as possible. Just because you've never been arrested, I mean, the real truth is that those of us that have spent a little time behind bars, we're not allowed back in for a little while, usually. Some of us are never allowed back in. We're usually never allowed back in facilities where you're an inmate in. So I just want to tell you that if you've not done that service, and you're looking for something to do in AA, and you thought that because you thought maybe they wouldn't identify with you, I'm just telling you to try it. I'm Irish Catholic. That's not shocking. I'm sure you pretty much figured that out already. And I'm not sentenced to a life in AA because I'm Irish Catholic. I know that. I'm the product of a family that is ravaged by alcoholism. Ravaged. That's not even an accurate description. My mom was an untreated, codependent Al-Anon for a long time housewife. My dad, you know, we always say in AA, you know, wow, we can't diagnose anyone's, you know. So I'm going to make it very easy for everyone. My dad died of the family liver disease. Take that with what you want to do with it, you know. If you're telling me I can't call him an alcoholic, I'm just going to tell you what he died of, and you can, you know, figure that out for yourself. But my mom was this untreated Al-Anon housewife, Brooklyn-era depression kid. And my dad was a raging alcoholic, highly decorated, deep-cover narcotics officer. In the 70s, his job was to buy as much heroin as possible in biggest amounts. he lived a life that, you know, sometimes I'll watch the occasional movie, usually isn't true, but every once in a while I'll see a movie that really hits home. You know, my dad grew up in a Studio 54, 1970s organized crime in Queens and Brooklyn. That's the atmosphere he lived in. He was my hero, but I can't tell you that was a conducive way to raise four children or to teach them good skills to have in life. You know, I can tell you my story, and I don't want to confuse anybody. I don't blame my dad or my mom for me being an alcoholic. I mean, when I finally surrendered and realized I was an alcoholic, it's the best thing I've ever decided. But I would be foolish to tell you that being raised in that house ravaged by the disease, the family disease of alcoholism, that that didn't affect me in many, many ways besides just having, you know, I suffer from the compulsion. I suffer from the obsession to have the first drink. But I learned lots of skills, conflict resolution skills that they don't teach in parenting class, I assure you. And I don't blame my parents for that, and I don't blame them for my disease, but it did make me who I am. And it has made me had to take a look at a lot of things. You know, growing up, you know, I appreciated the Marine Corps band because I buried my dad 2 years ago on his, like, last joke was we buried him on St. Patrick's Day. And I spoke at the Rhode Island State Convention a week later, and I'm at the podium, like, right there, and I think I hear bagpipes, and I'm like, what the? And I'm like, that sounds an awful like bagpipes. And next thing I know, the doors open and this bagpiper walks in playing Amazing Grace. I just had the Emerald Society band with my dad burying him. I was a mess. You know, I mean, but what I know is this. Only me and my siblings know what it's like in the middle of the night to have your dad come home from work. He hasn't been home in days. The wedding pictures haven't had glass in them in a long time. And, you know, you cower, and I hate to use that word because I'm a guy that came here who never lost a fight and was the toughest guy. But I'm telling you, a young boy who cowers in the basement room he lived in the closet or in the corner, praying that a gun doesn't go off, praying that my mom doesn't kill my dad or my mom doesn't kill herself or my dad doesn't kill himself, you know. You know, that's how I grew up. That doesn't make me an alcoholic, but it sure didn't help, I can assure you. And I was raised with, you know, a lot of rules. And, you know, not rules we teach here, that's for sure. You know, rules like we hate everyone except people like us, you know. That's a good rule we learned, you know. If you're not a cop or a fireman or a wildather or an iron worker or somebody with a trade union card in their pocket, you know, that's who my dad hung out with, you know. We learned rules like drugs are bad, drinking is great. Well, for an alcoholic of my type, that's a great rule. It's an outstanding rule. You know, we learned rules like a man never gives up his keys, you know, and that's just a rule we learned. And we also learned one of the most important rules in our household, which is what happens in the house stays in the house. It never leaves the house. It never goes to the bus stop or the classroom or wherever. It stays there. You know, and I have 42 first cousins, which isn't a lot where I come from. But I'll tell you what. In an Irish Catholic family, 42 first cousins means the following. It means that every spring, Saturdays become like this revolving door of christenings, first communions, confirmations, baptisms, graduations. It's like every weekend there's something else to do. And every weekend you're trained to do the same thing, which is dad hasn't been home in days. He showed up late last night. I stayed as long in my bed this morning as possible because I was afraid to go up and see what was broken. When I did go upstairs, Dad was sitting in his chair. The New York City Police Department Emerald Society Band album was on, and he was listening to that with tears rolling down his eyes, drinking a scotch. Now, that doesn't make me an alcoholic, but I assure you, it had its effect on me and my siblings. And then what happened is we completely ignore the last 3 or 4 days. We all get in the station wagon, and whether it's a 2-mile trip or a 40-mile trip, we're the perfect family when we get out of that car. And then once I go there, I learn the rules. Men and women are always apart. You know, my Uncle Frank always brings the poker chips and the bookie's phone number and the decks of cards, and the women stay over here and I play bartender. And at the end of the night, there's always going to be either a verbal or physical confrontation between my mother and my dad, or one of my aunts and one of my uncles, all about men not giving up their keys and pride. And then we get back in that car, and the happy, perfect family that we were is a complete disaster again. And that's how we lived. And, you know, by the time I was really, I'm not lying here, by the time I was 9 or 10 years old, you know, my dad was my hero. So, you know, any ounce of time I could get with him, I would. And a lot of times for me, it was payday. Every 2 weeks he got paid and he would drive in to get his check. And that's where I learned all my banking and finance skills. You know, I drove in to work with Dad. We went underneath this tunnel in another building because he was a deep cover and they'd go in a separate entrance, and he would get his check, and then we'd stop at all these bars and he would cash his check in his favorite bar and he would pay off his tab, and then he would go to a next couple of bars and pay off his tab, and then he would tell me that this is how much money I give Mom, and you always keep a little for yourself that you don't tell your wife about. I mean, the lessons you always teach a 9-year-old boy, you know, how to raise a 9-year-old boy. And, you know, I remember all those things, but I lived for that time with him. I really lived for it because he was my hero. It didn't matter. And, you know, it's hard for me to talk about my first drink. You know, what does that mean? I don't know what that means for you. I know what it doesn't mean for me. It doesn't mean splitting a beer with your dad at Yankee Stadium. It doesn't mean splitting a beer with your dad going on a fishing trip. It doesn't mean playing bartender and taking a sip here and a sip there. I can tell you what my first drink was, because my childhood wasn't great. I tried every possible mechanism to escape and not be me. I tried Boy Scouts so I wouldn't be home. I tried sports so I would go home, you know, be late at school. I tried everything because I didn't want to be the kid. You know, my dad finally left the house. And my gift to my mom was she got rid of the first Billy. And now the second Billy was just ready to start drinking and ready to even torture her more. And, you know, what happened to me was nothing ever worked. I don't know what happened to you, but nothing ever worked. So what happened one night? One night I'm in the back of, call it what you want. It's either a Duster or a Chevelle or an old Nova or a Monte Carlo. You know, it's the one that had the radio with the 2 beer caps put around the volume control knobs, you know. You know, it had the big equalizer that was bigger than a stereo. That car. Everyone that grew up, you know, I'm a product of the 70s and the 80s. Everyone knows that car. And, you know, what happened to me was that car went to a 7-Eleven, and I got my first 8-pack of Small Millers. And for me, that's my first drink, because what happened that night was a couple of things. Obviously, I drank my own 8-pack, but I felt as good as everyone else. And the more I drank, the better I felt. And I realized that I had found the jackpot. Forget sports, forget Boy Scouts. I found what works. I found what made me feel cool. I found what I thought made other people think I was cool. I found what works. And so that's what I always wanted to do. Every weekend from then on, I wanted to be in that car listening to Ozzy drinking my own 8-pack. You know, that's a good combination, you know. And I have the gift of being able to look back with a clear mind at my childhood now and at my drinking. And was I an active alcoholic, a real alcoholic as described in the big book? Yes. You know, and how do I know that? You know, well, there's a lot of ways I know it. You know, I know that I've never been able to start drinking and not want to continue. I've never been able to find a place in my life where I had one drink and didn't want to have another. I also know that, you know, like, kids love drinking games. Well, I hated drinking games, you know. I don't know if you play quarters out in California, but I know this. I never heard of anything so stupid that if you get a quarter in a glass, it's a punishment for me to drink. I never got that. You know, a punishment for me to drink. Like, if you point at me, that's bad. Meanwhile, I'd let you keep the quarter in the glass. Just let me keep drinking. I'm dying to let it get in the glass, you know? I'm the guy who, when he goes to the refrigerator in your parents' house, he's taking two Michelobes, not one. And I'm taking one and putting it in the Tupperware drawer or up in the glass drawer or wherever. Because you know what I realized? Is, you see, when you're 16 years old and you're in the back of that car and you're with those friends and you're going to that keg party, you know, when you're a teenager, a one keg party is a three keg party. A three keg party is a 10 keg party. There's the exaggeration factor. But you know what? For the other people in the car, they're comfortable knowing the amount of alcohol that's there. They feel comfortable. I don't know whether it's a nice word, panic attack. I don't know what you call it. I'm not comfortable. I'm not comfortable going anywhere without my emergency six-pack that I put in your parents' bushes for when the keg runs out, because I know it's going to run out. You know, I mean, that's just how I am. I don't know if that's how you drank, but at 16 years old, I can't run out of booze at 2:00 in the morning. I can't. I can't think of something worse happening. You know, I can think of two of my worst noises in my teenage years. One is a siren. That's always a bad noise. You know? And two is like when you have that nice cup tilted and that black hose in your hand and you hear nothing but air at like 1:30 in the morning. That's a horrible noise, you know? So I know that other kids, they don't worry about that. You know, I distinctly remember the Monsters of Rock concert at Giant Stadium for a lot of reasons. One, I had to sign a form saying I would agree not to be arrested. They would agree not to arrest me because I would agree never to come back to Giant Stadium. And they took my Polaroid and stapled it to the form I signed, and, you know, such is life. But the one thing I know about that concert is I used to have this really great, you know, I'm sure some people here remember the old green 3/4 length army jacket. And I had the Who Quadrophenia sign painted on the back. And what I liked about that jacket is you could fit like 8 beers inside it, you know. It was a great all-purpose jacket. And what I remember about Monsters of Rock is that they weren't using metal detectors yet, but they were starting that hat down line thing. See, my friends, they really wanted to go to the concert. They really wanted to go to the concert. So they were willing not to bring anything in. I couldn't think of anything scarier than to be in a stadium filled with 60,000 people and not have my own supply. So I'm willing to go through the pat-down line, and either I make it or I don't. But either way, I got my supply. See, because people like me are very fun to get, you know, if you're like me, you've watched a few concerts outside with people just like you who got thrown out. It can be a good time, you know? It can be a good time. And when I look back at my drinking, other kids didn't drink like that. And, you know, I just want to say very quickly, I just want to deviate for 2 minutes so I don't forget to say this. There was a director of loss prevention from Marriott sitting right with that gentleman sitting in the corner before. In 1993, I was on the host committee for IKIPA in New York City. In 1992, I had to write a letter with my sponsor to the director of loss prevention at the New York Marriott Marquis and ask him for permission to come back inside the hotel, because I had signed another one of those forms. But I signed another one of those forms not because I was cool at a concert. Because I was going up and down through that hotel looking for room service carts that had been pushed outside because I was starving. and I was just looking for a couple of French fries or an extra slice of pizza or a half-eaten cheeseburger. And I don't like to be up here dressed the way I'm dressed and admit that I've eaten food other people have eaten. But let's face it, folks, we're in a room full of people who've done a lot of things that, you know, we don't want to say from a podium. Pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization to me means the things I'll only tell one other person. They are not the things I'm talking about here. But I want to tell that story because I wrote that letter and said I wanted to be on this committee, and I was on this committee, and I was in charge of security, and my program at the time was sober softball 5 nights a week. And but I'll tell you what, that hotel company or this hotel company came back to me after that conference and asked me to come work for them. And that hotel company paid for some of my education. That hotel company took me from that job into a corporate job for them. And I am deeply probably in debt to it. But if you think that miracles don't exist in Alcoholics Anonymous, I am here to argue very hardly against that. I don't need to brag because I had nothing to do with it. Absolutely nothing to do with it. I'm just going to end that tangent by saying this. There's another hotel about 3 blocks north of that hotel. I'll say its name. It's the Holiday Inn Crown Plaza. It's every year where they have the General Service Conference, where all the delegates get together with the trustees for the one-week business meeting. That's another hotel that I used to walk up and down in looking for food when I was hungry. You know, 4 years ago, I walked into that room as a Panel 49 delegate to represent my area. You know, something I thought was impossible. You know, I walked into that room at midnight the night before it was set up, and I saw the sign 49th General Service Conference. You know, I might as well have been in pinstripes walking into Yankee Stadium with my name announced, because that's what it felt like. How is it possible that I could be in one situation and then in another? You know, and my drinking never changed. I have lots of great war stories and everything else. But, you know, my mom got a little help. God rest her soul. She went to the dark side, I'm sad to report. And, you know, I say that with as much love as I could possibly say it because, you know, I know sometimes probably I'm too giving to alcoholics. I think we as alcoholics have a lot of sympathy. But, you know, my high school yearbook said a couple of things about me in 20 years, a little hokey section that I was too cool to fill out. It said, Billy N. will have broken every bone and torn every muscle and ligament in his body. And then it said, I predict in 20 years St. John's Hospital will dedicate a wing to Billy N. Now, I thought in 1984 that I was cool. That meant I was a guy I wanted to hang out with. I was fun to bring to a party, fun to go to a concert with, a good guy to get into a fight with. You know, I thought that's what that meant. But I sit here today. I have no left kidney. I have no spleen. My ribs have been broken because I have I'm a blackout drinker who at 3 o'clock in the morning lose control of every muscle except for my mouth, which seems to work better, you know? And that is a bad combination, you know? You know, it's when you're lying on the floor of the Tipperary Inn and some guy is kicking you in the ribs and all you can do is, you know, say something else to him, you know? You know, as you feel that steel tip boot going into your rib again, and you have something else to say to him. It's incredible. My mother used to ground me a lot, and grounding me meant, it meant mom cooked dinner, mom went to bed, Billy went out the window at 10, Billy got really trashed, Billy got hammered, came back in at 6, went to bed, mom got up and went to work, she called at lunchtime and asked me if I learned my lesson, I said yes, and we started the whole thing all over again. Well, my mom, she learned some tricks. I learned that there's a really big difference between not allowed out and not allowed in. Not allowed in changes all the rules. It really does. Not allowed in seems like it should be illegal. Like, how can you do that to your teenage son, not let him in? And She also learned, you know, I don't know about you, but I had a bad habit of only calling the people I love when I was in trouble. And I used to chair the Cook County, Chicago Saturday morning jail meeting every other week when I lived in Chicago. And I used to always be amazed as I drove down on Saturday morning that I would pass the metal detector line and it would be out the door and around the corner in the freezing cold. And it would be all the family members. All the family members who haven't heard from these people since the last time they were arrested. And waiting out in the cold. It's amazing. And you know what my mother learned? One day I made a collect call home and the operator said, I'm sorry, that number doesn't accept collect calls. And I said, well, you got to be mistaken. That's my mom's house. I'm her son. Put me through. And someone told my mom that she couldn't hear my voice, so she couldn't hear the operator say, you have a collect call from Billy. She needed to just block it. And that seems a little cruel, too, to me. But I stand here today. I stand here today because she loved me enough to let me hit bottom. And, I went to my first AA meeting when I was 15 years old. School counselor thought it'd be a good idea. Kind of coached it that I'd learn a little bit about my dad. And, I heard a lot of interesting things there. I heard a guy say he didn't get hangovers, which really caught my attention. I was like, whoa. Because I went to the beach, got messed up, got into a fight with my girlfriend, came home, passed out, woke up the next morning, went up to the kitchen table, emptied out the ice cube trays into a beach towel, rolled it up, put it on my head, went back down to bed. That was how I survived. This guy said he didn't get hangovers because he didn't drink a day at a time. A little while later, I met this really hot bartender, and she told me that I didn't prepare how to drink good enough. And she said, you don't put the big glass of water out, you don't put the two Tylenols out, you don't coat your stomach before you go out, you need to coat your stomach, you need to come in, you need to take the Tylenols, you need to be hydrated. Well, for me, that was like a no-brainer. Door one seemed a little drastic, that no drinking a day at a time. Door two seemed like the kind of life plan I was looking for. It seemed like it was made for a guy like me. And many mornings I would wake up, the water would be spilt, who knows where the Tylenols are, empty White Castle boxes would be on my nightstand. Two tall boy traveling Budweiser cans would be there, It's like, but I'd try it again because giving up my best friend alcohol seemed a little harsh. It really did. And, to blow through my story a little bit, I just want to say that I stand here today and I suffer from alcoholism, not wasm. And I believe strongly, that if you're not committed to a group, and you're not taking someone through the process, and you don't have a sponsor, that I'm not in AA then. But a couple of things I learned back then, I had a feeling I was an alcoholic if I really looked deep down at myself. And I started getting arrested. I started getting in trouble. My dad's job kept me out of a lot of trouble for a long time. But what I learned is that it's good to know the lingo here if you don't really want to quit drinking. It's still good to know the AA lingo. Because it's important with certain people like probation officers and social workers. When you start to all of a sudden get arrested a lot, you realize that the guys who know the lingo, they fare better. You're like sitting in that group session and they're like, yeah, I went to a big book meeting, made a beginner's meeting, got a sponsor. You're like, boy, I got to find out what those things are because they don't seem to be focusing on them as much. I need to get that lingo down. And, went to lots of spring breaks and lots of concerts. And, if you would have asked me at 18 years old, what did I want to do? Well, I don't know, but I really like having a cold beer in my hand, listening to really loud heavy metal music outside. If I could do that every day, that seems just fine. And, when I say I suffer from alcoholism, it's because two things started to happen to me. The first is I started to wake up a lot of days in my late teens and early 20s with friends saying to me, Billy, you took it too far last night. You're putting my future in jeopardy. I want to go to the military academy. I want to go on the police department. I want to go on the fire department. All different things they would say to me. But then I would have one person say that I was like the king of the ball. Billy, that was awesome what you did last night. I'm really glad you hit that bouncer when he wasn't looking, you know? I'm really glad we got thrown out. It was worth it, you know? And I'm the kind of alcoholic that always goes with that 1 out of 10, you know? But the other thing, if I'm really going to talk about my disease and why I'm standing here today, is that I was never whole, ever. And I always had a burning hole in my stomach. And what happened to me is that I would wake up in the morning or in the afternoon, and I could identify 15 minutes or a half an hour of time the night before where it worked, where everyone wanted to be me, where I liked who I was, where girls loved me, guys were afraid of me, bartenders wanted me in their bars. I could identify that half an hour of time. Surrounded by 14 hours of sheer tragic terror disaster. But if you're an alcoholic like me, I like that half hour. I'm willing to risk it all again to feel okay. And I tore down everything. My family, my siblings. I mean, I brought them all crumbling down. And the reason I say I still suffer from alcoholism is I'm going to tell you a story about a couple of years ago. So obviously, in sobriety, close to 10 years, I had a couple of knee surgeries. And my doctor said to me, Billy, you should maybe not play league softball a couple nights a week anymore. What he was really saying is, grow up. You're not 18 anymore. What are you doing to your body? But he said it in a nice way, and I said, you're right. I'm not going to play softball anymore. No league, no AA club. So I'm walking down Lakeshore Drive in Chicago. There's a place called Montrose Beach. There's an AA picnic going on. And I see like the formation of like this diamond. I can see it. There's like, it's a pickup game. There's a mitt here. There's somebody's shirt there. There's a bat, but there's bases. And the first thought I had to myself was, you know, the doctor wasn't talking about pickup games. He was talking about league, you know? He was talking about league softball. So I'm down at this softball field at this AA picnic, and I'm in left field all of a sudden. And there's a guy up at bat who I don't like. So why don't I like him? A, he's very good looking. B, he looks like he could possibly, almost, maybe be as good as me. You know, my ego will take it at least that far, you know, and he hit a really good ball the first inning. So second time up at bat, he hits a wicked line drive. And anyone who's played baseball for a day, never mind as long as I have, would say this is going to bounce one time on the ground into my mitt. I am going to throw it to second base and he is going to be held at first. Well, that night I limped to Lakeshore Drive with a Ziploc bag of ice duct taped around my knee. My shorts were completely ripped open. I had dried blood all over the place. My knee was like this big. And the only thing I could think to myself was, that may have been the greatest catch I've ever made. And it's worth every ounce of this pain, you know? Just like my drinking. You know, I was able to identify 5 minutes where I was on top of the world. And to make matters worse, there's a Sunday night young people's big book group in Chicago. And I'm sitting there like 2 months later. And this guy comes up to me like 2 months later and goes, you know, that might have been the greatest catch I've ever seen. And I'm like, I knew it was worth all that pain. My drinking never changed. My drinking never changed. And I learned that you people aren't scared straight. You're not fortune tellers. You don't read crystal balls. But you do tell me what happened to you. Which, once you've been around here a while, is devastating. Because you see, at 23 years old, I still needed to drink a day at a time. And at 23 years old, I had one of those car accidents that you see public service announcements made about. And at 23 years old, my life came crashing down. And you know what? That car accident does not make me an alcoholic. And I'm not here to thump the big book tonight. Because I don't think, you know, I'm here to maybe be a messenger of hope for one person. But I love that line that says, "We're men and women that lost the ability to control our drinking, period." It does not say, comma, and went to jail, and killed someone in a car accident, and went bankrupt, and got divorced. It just says, period. And that's period. And, you know, that car accident doesn't make me an alcoholic, obviously. But I don't know about you, but one of the paradoxes that I hate about Alcoholics Anonymous is that you asked me to stop drinking when I needed to drink the most. And that's a very hard thing for, I think, new people. Because I don't meet anyone who says to me in a meeting, hey, Billy, you know, yeah, my life's been going good for 4 months and put a lot of changes in place, and I thought AA would be the next good thing to slide right in. I've never met somebody like that, you know? I've never. You know, I meet people like me who are mentally, physically, morally, spiritually, completely bottomed out with no place left to go. And I, you know, they say it in New York all the time. If there's someplace else to go, then you go there. You know, that's what happens when there's someplace else to go. You go there. And, you know, I hated AA for a long time. I didn't come in here, you know, saying, you know, oh, I can't wait to go home. But, you know, in New York, they say these five things that I think mean a lot. Get up and say help. Who cares who you're talking to? Call another alcoholic during the day, and it doesn't count at a meeting. Read 2 pages of AA literature. Go to a meeting and go to bed and say thank you. And I held on to those five things, even when I hated AA, even when I lost my job, even when I knew I was going to jail, even when my family had turned their backs on me because they should. They had had it. And, you know, my mom, and God rest her soul, you know, I stayed at her house. She let me stay there the night before I went to jail. And when she drove me, she told me that she couldn't come into court. She was fine, like, picking me up, but she was not fine with dropping her oldest son off. And, like, this isn't bail court. This is, like, you know, where the judge tells you how long you're going away for. You put your hands behind your back. The court officer handcuffs you. He takes you out to the big bus with the red star on it. He chains you to 15 other guys, and you get on the bus to go somewhere to live. And my mom told me, I can't watch it. I can't look at it. And I told her, and I'm not very proud of this, but if there's anybody here who's having difficulty with your parents and you're new, or anybody in your family, you know, my advice is really to, you know, act a little better than you feel, because you don't know how long they're going to be here. I turned around and said to her, you know, Mom, you and Dad should be going to jail. You should have never gotten married. You had no business having children. It was a disastrous home we were raised in, and now I'm going to jail. And I want to talk, you know, a little bit about what AA's given me. You know, what do I have now? What has AA given me? How has sobriety been? You know, meetings in jail meant a lot to me. You know, one night a week, meeting somebody from the outside, going to a meeting meant a lot to me. Having people write a letter or two to me while I was in there a week meant a lot to me. And, you know, miracles happen. You know, I got transferred to minimum security in November of 1990, or October of 1990. And it's the last time I've had handcuffs on. And, in our little meeting there, we had tapes. We were allowed to have a Walkman as long as it didn't have AM, FM. I'm dating myself pre-CD. You know, I hate to even admit that, but I'm getting old. And anyway, I listened to this tape, and this speaker said that sobriety time in jail doesn't count. So I told him my rule. So I just said, I hate all speakers. Never listening to another tape. You know, because I'll say it very bluntly. How dare anyone say that? It's not easy to live a day at a time by these spiritual principles in that jungle. And you do what you can to get by day by day. But the chance to get drunk or high is there just as much as it is outside. And so I hated all speakers. I didn't even know what a speaker was. I'd never been to a convention. And then what happened was is I walked into that tape library one day, and there was a tape sitting on the top. And it said, Tom I, Aberdeen, North Carolina. And for whatever reason, I picked it up. I don't know why. And I brought it back to my cot, and I listened to that tape of a man who, when he was 23 years old, killed two people drinking and driving. And now he was like 35 years sober, and he was a warden of a prison, and he had a family. And, you know, that was the hope that I needed. You know, if you're going to meetings and you haven't heard your story, stop looking for you telling it. That's my advice. You know, that's my advice. You know, if I'm going to a meeting waiting for some other Irish Catholic moron, you know, to tell my story, I better get online, you know, because my experience is I've heard it more often than not from people who look nothing like me. Because if you were gay, I wasn't listening to you. If you were a woman, I wasn't listening to you. If you were black, I wasn't listening to you. Because how could you know what it's like to be me? See, when I came in, I thought you were going to write a new chapter, the worst case to ever come to AA, you know? I've given up on that. I'm waiting for a new chapter titled, How to Listen to Your Favorite Song and Drive the Speed Limit, you know? That would, if I could make a recommendation in sobriety, you know, because I'll tell you, when you have a driver's license and you have no warrants and a really good song comes on, you know, I have those old tendencies, you know. And but when I got out and I went to AA, a lot of miracles happen. A lot of miracles happen. And like I said, I'm not here to take you through the steps, but I am here to tell you. I would find somebody who's been through them out of the book. I would find someone who knows that there's 36 principles in this program, not 12 or 24. I would find someone who, you know, is in AA and not around AA, because people around AA die. People around AA drink. People in the middle of AA stay sober. That's my experience. And I just spoke at this meeting called Never Had a Legal Drink in New York City at their group anniversary. And I had to reflect on my experience as a young member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what's hardest for me to look at is success has taken out or killed more of the people I know than hard times. That drives me crazy. My experience with hard times is that I've never been a better member of AA when things are hard. My experience with good times is much different. You know, when you're walking down the elevator ramp in Newark Airport and I have my laptop in one hand and my overnight in another, and I just flew first class and my driver is waiting for me with my name held up to take me home, and I can turn around and say, oh, Billy, you've done a remarkable job with yourself, you know? Just a hell of a job with yourself. And, you know, I've done nothing except be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I told you those five things I was taught, and I was taught to get involved in service, no matter what it is. And I was always taught that it's not you don't have a gift. It's not everyone needs to be a speaker or everyone should be a GSR. It's The sin is not finding out what your gift is and then not using it. Because every one of us has a gift to give back in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if you're building a new Alano club and putting a roof on, don't call me. I can't swing a hammer, you know? I mean, but there's someone in AA who has that gift. There's people who work miracles across diner tables. There's people who, in a 15-minute span of time driving to and from a meeting, are miracle workers better than others. But that's what I've been taught, that the sin is not finding out what your gift is. And you know, I stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I want to close by telling you some things that happened in my life. My story. I remember when my grandmother died. And a guy at Chelsea Riverside, which is called Chock Full of Nuts. And I hear that there's a meeting in Hollywood now called New York, New York on Wednesday nights. I got to go to it when I'm here on business. Because it's based on Chelsea Riverside, which is this. Chelsea Riverside is the meeting you walk into Manhattan, and in the back of the room, there's a guy wearing a full-length fake mink coat in the middle of the summer with a radio with no batteries in it, dancing it, and everyone says hello to him, you know? That's Chelsea Riverside, you know? You know, Midnight Madness in New York City, I've seen lots of things there. They might not always look like AA, but I'll tell you what. When I was 25 years old, at 11:30 at night on a Saturday night, I still don't know how to go to bed. You know, it's still hard for me to understand that it's easier to get up if I go to bed early. I'm willing to try everything else, you know, except go to bed early. Go to bed early seems like giving up on life. I was at this big executive management retreat in Naples, Florida a couple weeks ago with my bosses, and I flew on the same flight as them. They drank from Newark to Naples. They drank on the fishing trip in the afternoon. They drank at the award ceremony at night. I smoked a couple of cigars and drank club soda all day. And they get up better than me. How is that possible? You know? How do I still have a hard time getting up? And but the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous, when my grandmother died, told me, "Oh, Billy, you have to go. This is not optional. You're a member of the family now. You borrow a suit and tie. No one's going to come up to you and say, 'Oh, sorry to hear you're not out there messing up your life. Sorry to hear you're not in jail. Sorry to hear you're not puking your guts out in the middle of the night.'" I was taught to show up. And you know, I just want to tell you that when I was at that, I was downstairs. I still smoked like 2.5 packs of Newports a day then. And I was downstairs in the smoking room at the funeral home, and my Aunt Sheila walked down, my dad's sister, and she was always known as Crazy Aunt Sheila because she was crazy. And and her sons always lived with us when she was where crazy people go. And I was the son who had been missing from a lot of family events for a long time. So now I'm in AA, I go to this funeral, and she walks downstairs, and she looks like unbelievable. And I had heard that, like, she went back to school, got her PhD, was a dean, and she walked up to me and she said, "Billy, it's so good to see you. I heard you're sober in AA." And I said, "Yeah, Angela, I'm sober almost 2 years." And she said, "That's great. Is that guy upstairs from your AA group?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, I've been sober in AA and abstinent in OA for 14 years. And that lady upstairs is from my group, too." And you see, I had known how Aunt Sheila was. I knew how she was today. But I never knew what happened. And what happened is such an important part of all of our stories. And lots of things have happened after their work and career and staying involved in service and, you know, bad times, good times. But AA has taught me everything. I mean everything. I learned how to tie a tie here. I learned that you can't get a job without filling out an application here. I learned you can't get rid of a toothache without going to the dentist. You know, I learned lots of things here. I learned how to grow up here. I learned to shine my shoes if I go on an interview. I learned to show up at a hotel and be part of a conference committee and talk appropriately and act appropriately and dress appropriately. I learned, you know, sometimes at work they give me like these really challenging assignments with people that are fighting. And they say, "Well, give that group to Bill." you know, if you've been on one of these AA conference committees, it's like a cakewalk, you know? If you've been involved in AA or Al-Anon service, it's like, you know, send me over to Israel. I'm ready to give it a shot, you know? Because if you can survive one of our assemblies or one of our committee meetings, I mean, we teach a lot of patience and tolerance here. And two things I just want to finish by saying is this. One is, I told you I hated everyone. And the first man that really helped me out was a black man. And he taught me more about being a man than I ever knew. One of the confusing things I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is everything that my dad taught me that meant you were a man really has nothing to do with being a man. And everything I was taught meant you weren't a man really makes you a man. See, I was taught that if you help out with Little League and are a Boy Scout leader, that you've caved in. If you deposit your check in banks and give you, you know, you've caved, you know. And this man, you know, it's funny, we used to walk down Broadway and he'd have his Malcolm X, the movie just came out, he'd have his Malcolm X baseball hat on, I'd have my Fighting Irish baseball hat on. We walked down Broadway and he taught me how to live. And he was more kind and compassionate than anyone I could ever met. And then the men and women at midnight, a lot of them were gay. And I got to be perfectly honest, up to that time, my household, not a lot of contact with the gay community, you know? Just wasn't. And I wouldn't even go out after the meeting with them, you know? And I'm being perfectly honest here. The thought in my head was, I'm not sitting in public with a table full of queers, you know? I'll be in the Smithtown News police blotter section, but I'm not doing that, you know? I got to tell you that the men and women at midnight who became my dearest friends taught me more about tolerance. Those are the kind of people who knew that when I had my first job in sobriety, that by the time I went to the Saturday night young people's meeting, I was broke to the next paycheck. Because when you haven't had money for a while, let me tell you, we all know how it is. You get that first paycheck, I don't care if it's for 80 or 800. You know, you feel like you're on top of the world and you have no money left. You know, but those are the people that gave you a buck to put in a basket. Those are the people that if they knew you had no money, they told the waiter to give you a check so that nobody ever knew. And, you know, my brother Terrence, in typical my family style, where when you have a major announcement to make to the family, you do it as drunk as possible with as big an audience as possible, especially if you know it's going to set the house on fire. Well, at my sister's Christmas party, he decides to drop the bomb completely loaded that he's gay. And went over really well. And what I can tell you is this, though, and I mean this. How lucky I was. What I've learned in AA is that a lot of times things are going on in my life in sobriety. I don't know why they're going on, but later I find out God had a purpose. God had a reason. Because I knew it was just my job to be my brother's brother, to be his friend. You know, that it didn't matter. It just didn't matter. And I want to talk about my mom. You know, I talked a little bit about her. And, you know, I hated her even in sobriety. And those are strong words. But, you know, she wouldn't let me home for Christmas or Thanksgiving for my first two holiday seasons out of jail. Because she said I was too disruptive to our other three children who were in college and home for the holidays. And that she needed to protect them. And that she needed to give them an atmosphere where they weren't exposed to me. And I spent a lot of Thanksgiving and Christmases at the 79th Street Workshop in New York City. And God bless those people for having that and letting me have a place to go and letting me have a place to eat dinner with everyone else. But, you know, I grew to love that woman, my mother. Love her beyond I can't even explain. Every quirky, crazy thing about her that I hated, I grew to love. You know, I hated being the only kids in the supermarket where she had the coupon box in alphabetical order, you know, and she would only shop on triple coupon day, you know, and I just, you know, and you can only get one pair of new Levi's a year, you know, and I really grew to love her. And a couple of years ago, I got a phone call from my sister that she was suffering from, that she just got diagnosed, you know, at stage 4 inoperable lung cancer. And I was devastated. And at first I looked at it like, this really sucks. You know, why are you taking her away now? I like her now. I like the things that used to drive me crazy about her. And then I finally realized I got a lot of extra time with her. I shouldn't have. A lot of extra time. And I just want to say that on Christmas Eve, 1999 into 2000, she was in a hospice. She looked like a cancer patient in her final days. That night I went home and I wrapped her last Christmas gift in tears. I opened up my laptop and there were tons of emails from people in AA, and I couldn't keep my cell phone clear of the calls. And I watched my siblings drink because they don't have to worry about drinking. And what happened was is that, you know, I woke up the next morning and I went and I got her wig. I got her makeup. I got her perfume. I stopped and got her a large Dunkin' Donuts coffee. And I went to the hospice. And I brought her crazy Irish music and all her Christmas cards to hang up and a picture of her cat. And we had it catered. But that morning, I jumped up. The bed was propped up. I jumped up next to her. I put her makeup on. I put her lipstick on. I thought, boy, if the guys at midnight could see me now, they would be laughing. And we both threw back a large Dunkin' Donuts coffee. She told me the final arrangements she wanted. She told me never to leave AA. That her, you know, her prayer about me is that she hopes I never drink again. And 2 weeks later, I came back to see her again, and she really couldn't talk to me. And I don't know if she knew if I was there or not, but someone in AA had told me, I had told them how bad it was getting. And they said, Billy, the next time you go see her and you leave, you reach down and you whisper to her, Mom, it's okay to go. You're in too much pain. We'll be okay, and you don't have to live like this anymore. And, you know, I did that, and 4 days later I got home to Chicago, and, you know, I got the call that she died, and I cranked Metallica Hero of the Day as loud as possible and cried my eyes out. And I went to a podium a week later, just like this in a church in New York, and I said to the crowd how hard it was for a very far from perfect son to come and say goodbye to a very close to perfect mother. And, you know, the Marines were just here. My brother was captain in the Marine Corps at the time and in his dress blues. And, you know, I saw people look at me. They don't understand what happened because they know the old me. They haven't seen me in a while. And what happened is Alcoholics Anonymous has done a lot better job with me than I have. And I owe the people in AA everything. And I've heard more miracle stories here. And, you know, 2 weeks ago I was traveling like 4 days in a row. And I came home on a Monday night. And I went to my home group. And then I had this appointment to start reading the big book with a guy. And I was like, God, I just don't feel like doing this. But the bottom line is, a guy who suffers from alcoholism like I do doesn't have a choice. You know, I'm a drink away. I know I am. And I know sometimes it's popular sometimes to hear people say it's God's will to pick up, but I don't believe that. You know, when I picked up and I went out and had my car accident, I think that was pretty much Billy's will. And God's will is for me to be a sober person and try to get better a day at a time and live closer like him, which is still a struggle. But for a guy like me to bury my mom with dignity and honor, and then a year later bury my dad legally blind, liver distended, left leg amputated because he was diabetic and he couldn't stop drinking. He was 62 and he looked like he was 93. At 25 years old, I used to say to myself, God, why did you let dad drink? Why is he allowed to have such a great life and my life sucks? I live in a single room occupancy hotel. My neighbor's a transvestite prostitute. Why is my life like this? But I'll tell you what. when I walked out of that church listening to Danny Boy with my dad's casket behind me, I didn't feel like the unlucky one. I felt bad that he never got the message. I felt bad that I wish he had. And, you know, if you're new to AA or you're coming back, if you hated everything I said, just keep going to meetings. Keep finding people. It doesn't always have to be, you know, AA is great, but it meant as much to me to go to my first Yankee game sober as it did to go to my first meeting, you know? Random acts of kindness, I know that's a catchy phrase, I don't like it, but when Mike Tyson fought Buster Douglas, my first 90 days of sobriety, I thought there were three big cultural events in that time. There was the Super Bowl, there was St. Patrick's Day, and there was my birthday. Three huge days that you possibly can't not drink through. And I white-knuckled it through the Super Bowl. And a couple weeks later was that fight. And I was in a meeting and a guy walked up to me and said, hey, my name's whatever. I don't even remember his name. He said, we have the fight on pay-per-view, a couple of guys. We got some pizza. Would you like to come? And I can tell you that the steps, the traditions, service, meetings, obviously they all help. But I'll tell you what, that guy letting me know that I could hang out with a couple of guys and life wasn't over, that guy who took me to Yankee Stadium and I realized I don't have to be totally wasted to enjoy a game, that my life's not over, that guy who took me to Metallica, Guns N' Roses, you know, your dreams come true here. My dreams, the limited ones they were, I should have been dreaming a little better. So I want to thank everybody for having me here tonight. I want to encourage you that if you haven't found the God of your understanding, that you keep looking. You keep finding someone who's found the God of their understanding, and you try to work the steps with them, not in a meeting, but one-on-one. Thanks.